Welcome to the show, Human Music. I'm your host, Mira Jo. On this show, I invite a guest musician to choose a song for us to talk about. We share our creative experiences and discover what inspires us. Today, my guest is Scotty Hayes. Scotty is a guitarist for the Vashon surf rock band Secret Agents. He started playing in a punk rock band called The Sleaze at the age of 12, and since then he's been playing in heavy metal bands and southern rock bands. Scotty, welcome to Human Music. Could you tell us how you started making music?
Yeah, well, I like to listen to the radio. I was adopted and an only child, so I didn't grow up with obviously many people, but I had a dog and a radio. It's all I really needed, actually. My dad saw that I was listening to the radio an awful lot. My mother and father are from just outside of Liverpool in England. So when they moved here, my dad always wanted a big American car. So he bought a big American car and saw that I was kind of music crazy. So he traded it. He traded his big American car for a drum set and a Sears guitar. He told me, learn how to play Beatles music. I didn't know what to do. There was a guitar. It was heavy to pick up and the drum set made a bunch of noise. I thought that was pretty great. But then he sent me to, I want to say music schools, but looking back, I don't think they were. I think they were just buildings with guitar teachers in them. And so that was a lot of fun, actually, learning how to play guitar from older people who had long hair and looked cool, and I respected that.
Listening to the radio has been kind of a theme for past guests and kind of that influence of radio on making music and listening to music. Do you remember like who was on the radio at that time, what it was about listening to the radio that just drew you in?
Yeah, absolutely. It was stuff on the radio was, there was a song I really liked when it came on. I think it was by Jim Croce, Bad, Bad Leroy Brown. That was on a lot. And I know the Monkees were on an awful lot. And the Supremes, the Beatles, of course, were always on. And the Rolling Stones were always on. The Rolling Stones always seemed like what the Beatles would be if they were knife-wielding maniacs.
So tell us a little bit about how you ended up in this punk rock band.
Oh, I was in junior high school and punk rock had just come out. It was pretty new. It was pretty exciting. The musicians, none of them were very good, but they were very interesting and fun to listen to. And it kind of made you want to jump up and down on your bed with a tennis racket and pretend like you were swinging a guitar around, kind of like when you listen to Pete Townsend. It was kind of that same vibe. Then one of the kids in my junior high school class, he said that he also liked the Sex Pistols, which the Sex Pistols and the Clash and the Damned and that sort of stuff was just coming out. And so we decided, well, God, we've got a drum set and we've got a guitar. Let's try to figure this stuff out. And we just kept learning more of those types of songs.
And then you played the guitar. Did you also sing, or what was the makeup of the band?
Well, usually at that age, when you start out, the singer is usually someone who says, ah, okay, I'll do it. Doesn't know how to sing. And that's still the case.
That's great. I think what's great about punk rock is that it is not polished. It's raw. It gets you pumped up, like you said. I also played in a all-girl punk rock band. It gets you pumped up. The audience is just like, there's this incredible energy. I can envision you jumping on that bed, getting a lot of that 12-year-old energy out.
Oh, it was great. I remember being the north of England with my parents, and it was in late 76 or early 77. I was young. What was I, about 10 or 11 years old? But I remember walking out of the house. My folks let me leave the house on my own. I was walking around, and I was going to downtown, the town called Warrington. I knew there was a record store there, and I saw some kids. They were older than I was, but not much. And one of them had green hair, and I'd never seen anything like that before. And I thought, wow, this is the epitome of coolness. And I followed that kid around for a couple hours, and I watched, looked at the records he was picking up. And then I picked him up after he did too, because I wanted to be as cool as the kid with the green hair. Yeah, it was kind of a fun time.
In the late 90s, I was traveling around Europe with the band, the punk rock band, visiting different squats and different communities of punk rockers. And there was just like more, I think, of a social, political underpinning for that, the punk rockers in Europe versus American punk rockers. There's just like a slight, not that one is better or worse, but there was just this kind of social consciousness. And I think a lot of it has to do with like so much political unrest in European countries, including like Eastern European.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So then what was your next step after the punk rock band?
Well, I just kept staying at home, not having a lot of friends to play with. Just stayed at home and played my guitar. That really made me happy. But I remember being in Kmart one day with my mom, and my mom gave me, I can't remember if it was $5 or $10, but she gave me some money, and she said that I could buy a new model to put together, a car model or an airplane model. I don't remember which one I wanted. But I walked around the store, and I thought, oh, here's the record section in Kmart. And I was rifling through them, not knowing anything except for, well, here's the Jackson 5, and here's the Beatles, and other bands that I had heard of. Well, I rifled through this band or through this record, and it was a darker cover, and there was four people on the front of this album, and they all looked like monsters and demons, and they were breathing fire and smashing things. And I thought, wow, this is the epitome of this is rock and roll right here. It's just breaking things. So I went to the counter as a young kid with this record. It was Kiss Alive 1. I think I wore that record out in probably 2 or 3 days. And so I started playing music like that. That was the next endeavor was the guitar player. His name was Ace Frehley, and he always had Gibson Les Pauls. And I always wanted a Gibson Les Paul, but those were a lot of money. You know, my dad could afford Sears guitars, and which were great. They were good, but you know, now I have a Les Paul, not because they're easier to play, but because Ace Frehley had one.
Yeah, it's so funny how these rock idols can just hold that sway over us. And compared to notoriety or fame these days, it was just like inspiration. It was based in inspiration, like true creative inspiration.
Oh, it was fantastic. It was almost like a religion. I wasn't buying into the religion thing, but I was buying into the Ritchie Blackmore thing and the Jimmy Page thing. And these guys were gods to me.
I love that you're talking about this kind of raw spiritual experience. There's a whole spectrum of spiritual experiences. You're tapping into something that's just, that music just dug right into you and churned up all of that stuff and had you spitting that out. And that's so cool. This, I can completely envision that.
Well, you know what's funny about music and it being perhaps maybe quote spiritual is people, I think, look for things that already reinforce their own beliefs. Like, I'm going to vote for this candidate because I already believe in that sort of stuff and he speaks to me. Or if you're a hyperactive child like I was, I wanted to be reinforced with that. So I listened to hyperactive music. And then there were other kids that were just happy, nice, and had wonderful families, and they listened to really happy music because it reinforced their beliefs. And the kids that were setting fires and dumpsters and breaking windows, I don't know what they listened to, but I'm sure it was something more aggressive.
You really just need 3 chords.
You can do a lot with 3 chords.
Do a lot.
Well, actually, you know, you can do a lot with 1 chord. You can play, I mean, there's so many, there's a, this chord, and there's it's just 1 chord. If you just keep separating it, you get different notes. If you're looking for dissonance, you take your finger off of one of those notes that are in the scale, or move it down to a minor third, and you're no longer in the scale, and it's still the same chord, I suppose.
That's sort of the magic of, I think, being in your room alone playing music, is it really is a lot of noodling.
Yeah.
And just seeing what hits, like throwing spaghetti on the wall, you know, seeing what sticks. That's what keeps music fun, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the best anybody ever plays, is when they're at home alone and the only person watching them is their dog. It's a lot of stuff comes out that you wish you remembered later on.
Yeah, sometimes I try to keep a running recorder going, but there's just so much. And, you know, I'm not one who can easily go back and listen to everything and edit it again. It's just, that sounds like work to me. So when you start writing songs, like how does that evolve when you hear something that you're noodling with? And how does that become something like a song?
You'll play around with something that's maybe in a scale, but it doesn't look quite right if you look at it, but it's still in the scale. Like if you're playing A, let's use A again. You play that by accident and you think to yourself, wow, that was actually kind of cool. So you try to incorporate it into something else, or you hit a duff note and you think, that's not going to quite work out for that feeling that I was looking for, but it has that minor feel to it. And you think, well, we could start a song out in a more minor scale, which creates tension. And you don't always have to resolve tension, but people like to resolve things. So if you start out, get the feel of the A, and you start out with perhaps and do your noodling or play chords or listen to somebody sing, and then the end of the song, you resolve it by coming back to the major in the same key. Then you're done. And you can go have your coffee.
And kind of the songs that just come right out and are fully formed as you write them versus the songs that you have to work a little harder at, do you kind of are guided differently by those two experiences?
No, I'm super self-conscious about it. I'll ask my wife, what does this sound like? And she's like, yeah, it sounds great. And I'm totally kidding. She doesn't say that. Or I'll bounce it off my band members, Toby or Emery. I'll say, is this good? Is this bad? If we're going for this type of feel, we want this to happen, and we want to feel like this. You know, but everyone hears stuff differently. You know, I may hear something and it sounds like, oh, this is really sad. I want to jump out of a window now. And someone else may hear it and go, wow, that's great. And now I want to bake cookies. So things are different for each people, but I like to bounce it off those guys because they seem to have a better ear than I do. You know, and part of it too is you play something and you think, well, it was a little bit easier to play it this way. So you just end up playing the easier stuff.
Sometimes simple is best. So how did the band Secret Agents come about?
I was playing with a local musician or a couple of local musicians. And COVID hit. And so we weren't actually allowed to practice. Well, it was the responsible thing to do. We didn't practice for about a year and a half. But we would talk to each other on the phone and think, oh, well, when we get back together, let's do these fantastic things. And that never really happened. Once we did start playing again, my drummer, Tim Norton, he's a great drummer. He was also playing in another band. He was singing in a punk rock band, or a really good band. So he was splitting his time between us and those guys, and he wanted to pursue that. So I thought, oh man, I'm never going to find another drummer like Tim. So I called a bunch of people and I played with some people, and it just didn't feel right. And I got a hold of this younger guy. His name is Emery. And I heard, oh, this guy's really good. Well, he came over and played, and oh my God, this guy's fantastic. I mean, he's the guy. And he liked to play swing jazz, but he also likes surf music. So that's about all we discussed. It was pretty much, do you want to do this thing? And I was like, yeah, okay. And that was about it.
Sounds a lot like you going back to your early years, being inspired by people on the radio. When you met Emery, there was like an inspirational spark there where you're just like, wow, this guy really speaks to me on some level. let's try to make that happen.
And not by the way of, hey, Emery, play in a way that complements this guitar. It wasn't that at all. It was like, this guy's fantastic. I thought, oh, I've got to adjust and play to his style because he's great. And then we've got a bass player, Toby Holmes. That guy's fantastic. You know, he just bought a new bass. He's happy about that. He bought a Schecter bass. And he's just coming along so fast that, you know, we'll give him something. Hey, let's learn this song. Which is unusual for a musician. You tell someone, hey, let's learn this song, and they'll show up a couple of days later and they'll say, okay, how does the song go? Or let's learn it now. Well, he'll show up and he'll learn the song, which is kind of unusual, which I'm sure you know. And so, yeah, it's really easy playing with these guys.
And you're also speaking to this idea that musicians are not one thing or one genre, one type of music. It's really this flexible, fluid, creative process that's not categorizable or able to put into a box.
You mean musicians in general?
Musicians in general.
Well, sure. I guess it's like, it's just another art form. And, you know, if you understand art, you can do the same thing or get the same feelings from sculpting with clay or painting with oil or going to a gallery. I don't really see any difference. People ask sometimes, I want to get into music, but my fingers hurt or I have these roadblocks. And I say, you don't have to get into music. You can, get into building birdhouses or painting. It really doesn't matter, just as long as there's some kind of a creative output.
This is the show Human Music. I've been talking with my guest, Scotty Hayes. You're listening to KVSH LP Vashon, your listener-supported island connection. Let's take a quick break.
Voice of Vashon programming support is brought to you by Island Insurance Center, trusted agents ready to help you navigate the insurance world and find the best coverage for your insurance needs. Whether it's for your home, auto, small business, farm, or nonprofit, don't wait for peace of mind. Contact us today. To schedule a free policy review and to learn more, visit islandinsurancecenter.com.
VOV programming support comes from Vashon Thriftway, locally owned and operated since 1965 and offering everything from organic zucchini to a hot latte or garden boots. Now supporting youth sports broadcasts on KVSH, you'll find them on the web at vashonthriftway.com.
Welcome back to the show, Human Music. On this show, I invite a guest musician to choose a song for us to talk about that's meaningful to them, and we share our creative experiences and discover what inspires us. My guest today is Scotty Hayes. Scotty, which song did you choose and why?
Hey Jude by the Beatles was really important to me growing up. My dad a lot of times would work nights, and I wouldn't see him a lot, but as a little kid, at night, my mom would pick me up and she'd put me to bed and tuck me in and do all the mom stuff. And then my dad would walk in and my dad would sit on the bed and we'd talk for a little bit. And I really liked that. I really liked talking with my dad before I went to bed. And he had a little tiny record player, and I always thought it was my record player, but it probably wasn't, but he had these 45s. We'd go to Kmart and he'd buy these 45s. And he had this 45 of Hey Jude. And my dad, being from England and wanting to know more about American culture, like I said earlier, he bought a big American car and he would say things sometimes like dude. And so he would call me his dude or Blossom. I don't know where the Blossom part came from, but he'd call me dude. And then he would play this song on this 45 record. I think it was yellow vinyl, if I remember right. And he would play it, and I thought they were saying, hey, dude. And as a little kid, I thought, oh, all right, cool. This song's for me, and my dad's gonna sing it. And they're saying, hey, dude. I'd lay in bed, and we'd sing the song together. Actually, for a while, we would do this every night. I just assumed when they said, hey, Jude, they were saying, hey, dude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. And in my child's mind, I thought, okay, this song is supposed to start out bad, but it's getting better because people get to sing it with their dads while they're going to sleep. I thought that's actually what that meant.
Let's listen to the song Hey Jude by the Beatles.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid. You were made to go out and get her. The minute you let her under your skin, then you begin to make it better. And anytime you feel the pain,
That was the song Hey Jude by the Beatles, as if there's anyone who doesn't know that, but just in case. What strikes me is that na-na-na-na at the end, it goes on for a while, but you just don't want that song to end.
Oh, yeah, you wanted to keep it going. For me, personally, laying in bed, and I got to yell that with my dad for a long time. That was just a lot of fun. And it kind of reinforced that the song, what I thought was about me and my family, my mother's mom, I called Nana to differentiate from my dad's mom, who was grandma. So at the end of the song, they're talking about my mom's mom, my Nana.
Yeah, Paul McCartney said he wrote that for Julian Lennon after John left the marriage and got together with Yoko. And so it was his way of comforting Julian, Jules, Jude. So funny how that sort of mirrors exactly your experience with the song.
Yeah.
Right? On some level, as a kid, you just picked up on that. I mean, what is that? That underlying subconscious thing that you can't really say, look at the song and as a whole and say, oh, this is what it's about. But there, you picked up on that as a kid.
Well, you pick up on things, like I was saying, that already reinforce your own beliefs. And especially when you're a little kid, when there are simple repeating patterns, that's something that you can do even without your dad. Heck, you can walk down the steps when you're ready to pet your dog, and you can sing that song and not get confused. It's simple over. The funny thing about the Beatles is they have these patterns. A lot of majors. Sometimes later on, it seemed like there were minors to get some more dissonance, more emotional feeling. But for the most parts, there's even minor thirds, and these minor thirds overlap into fourths sometimes. But they're just happy notes. They rise and then they fall, and that's it. It seems like with some of that Beatles stuff, what goes up must come down. Like the song Blackbird, it's really simple repeating patterns, and it starts in a G and kind of winds up using major thirds, and it gets to the top, which the top is just an octave higher of the original G you started in, and then it winds back down and finishes with that same G and ends up being resolved. And it's really easy to follow that stuff.
And the way that the song builds, it starts just with the vocal and then adds the tambourine and then adds the instrumentation. So it does exactly what you're saying, that simple building of a song that gets you into the song and then up into get elevated to that climax and then take you out of the song. And they did this in that song, this song, with the instrumentation on some level too.
Absolutely.
And the second line, take a sad song and make it better, kind of speak to what you were talking about earlier. Is this a sad song? Is this a happy song? When you're sort of writing a song, going through the creative process, you sort of don't know. And it's kind of a mix of emotions. It's not a straight emotion.
It can be, sure. It seems, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems that McCartney's songs were pretty happy and pretty easy and easy to follow. And Lennon's songs seemed to morph into something that was perhaps a little bit darker and a little bit deeper. Whether McCartney felt that way or not, it seems to me that he was more of, well, let's stick to this proven formula, which is let's start out here, rise up with these parts, and then come back down and settle everything out, and everyone's happy, and everyone's having a good day. And Lennon wanted to, it seems to me anyway, that Lennon wanted to invoke more thought, which isn't bad. It's just takes more work listening to it.
And on the vocal level, do you prefer McCartney or do you prefer Lennon?
Ooh, loaded question. I don't know. Who do you prefer?
I'm a Lennon person through and through, because I think there's like an angstiness there that exactly what you're talking about. And I can be an angsty person. So that part speaks to me.
No, I like that. You know, it wasn't until McCartney got into the Wings, he started hitting these incredibly high notes and screaming his bottom off, that I realized, holy mackerel, this guy has a really good voice. So I may have to go with McCartney. But at the same time, whenever you would hear Ringo sing, it didn't seem like it was that fantastic. It seemed like he was, it seemed like he wasn't as polished, and he was, and it almost seemed like when he was in the studio, the other guys were looking at him and kind of chuckling. And that's got an appeal also.
I'm also a George Harrison fan too.
It's hard to go wrong.
It's hard
to, Fab Four.
It's hard to go wrong. But there's that documentary of the behind the scenes and the conflicts between Harrison and McCartney and Lennon. It came out recently, all this unreleased previous footage that led to their last live performance on the roof of that building in London.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of tension in the band, and it makes me think about kind of the McCartney's more straightforward roots to maybe how they started off in the Quarrymen, where there were more of a skittle group that did like the circuit.
Mm-hmm.
So this American folk, blues, country, bluegrass, jazz, and kind of the standard kind of sound. And then McCartney kind of took that and with his bass lines and his lyricism and his melodies. And then there was that layer of Lennon that was mixed in with that, and maybe, and that's, I would say, definitely what the longevity of the Beatles comes from, all of those tensions. And I'm sure you know, bands can be pretty explosive in terms of personalities. And if you can channel that.
It's a weird thing. It's, I don't know whether egos get in the way or the lack of egos get in the way. I don't know what it is, but it is a weird thing. You get together and you share these common goals. Like I want to express an art form, an audible art form such as music. I want to do it in this particular way. And you get together with other people and they share the same thing. That's kind of a rare thing. And then you end up arguing about it. That's bizarre.
I feel like it's like your family where you just, their heart and soul are on the line, and it just brings up all of those dynamics, and you just want to be heard, and you want to express yourself, and everybody's trying to do that. And it doesn't always match up.
It doesn't always match up, no. No, it's like playing live sometimes. You want to be, you think, oh, it's not going to sound good. Or musicians think, it's not going to sound good unless I'm loud. And then the other musician is like, oh, I need to be loud. And everyone wants, can I be a little bit louder in here? And everyone's telling the sound person, I want more of this in my headphones, and I want more of that. And at the end of the evening, it just ends up being so painfully loud. It's actually kind of comical, but that happens all the time. There was a funny line on a Deep Purple record where the singer, Ian Gillan, kept asking the sound man at this live show. I might have been in Japan somewhere. He kept saying, can I have a bit more of this in my headphones? Can I have a bit more of this in my monitor? And then he finally said, I want everything louder than everything else, because he realized how silly it sounded.
The na-na-na-na at the end also draws you in, I think, when you're talking about like the volume levels. The mix on this song is incredible. The way at the end that the screaming, this kind of unleashed screaming is what I would call it. Mm-hmm. It's singing, but it is very visceral, let's say. I wonder if that must have been McCartney, no? Or we don't know who was singing that at the end, but I'm assuming it was McCartney.
Oh, who was doing the screaming?
Screaming, yeah.
Yeah, I assumed it was McCartney.
But that, the volume on that was, that the vocals was kind of lower, and the na-na-na-na-na's were, the volume was higher. So it was sort of in the background, that kind of unleashed emotion. And, you know, I know they were influenced by American music. And that year, 1968, James Brown's top 100 song was I Got the Feeling at number 58. And so there, I was immediately thinking about James Brown when I heard that at the end.
I never thought of that. That's a good point.
Yeah, it's a little uncharacteristic for McCartney. No, you, because imagine it starts, the song's that let's make a sad song, take a sad song and make it better.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, I guess he did scream a little bit. What was that song earlier on? She Loves You. He did a bit of screaming in that, I suppose.
Yeah, so he had that side to him.
Yeah.
He was a complex...
yelling side.
He had the yelling side. He was a complex guy. Like, what is your emotional journey through that song when you listen to it now versus when you listen to it as a kid?
I think for me, it's probably the same because, you know, I lost my dad a few years ago. When I hear the song now, I'm a little bit jaded because that's what the song means to me. The song means spending time with my dad as a little kid and looking up to my dad as a hero and as a role model. And he allowed me to be in part of his world, which was a father figure. And I got to sing with him. And whether we hit the right notes, we didn't. Whether we hit the right notes or not, didn't really matter. It was just singing with my dad. And I hear that song now, and sometimes I have to ignore it and think of something else because this sounds totally cheesy, but sometimes I get a little bit choked up, like, wow, am I actually is my eye going to leak a little bit here? I'm not going to say I cry because I don't do that. But yeah, sometimes a little bit of water might come out and I think, okay, I got to do something else because this just looks kind of silly right now. That's what Hey Jude means to me is being with my dad.
What a beautiful gift that is. You know, when you think about people passing, and it sounds very difficult, losing your father. When you think of things, like what happens to their things? And to have this gift of a song that kind of lives in this place, you'll never lose it. You'll never have to figure out which closet it's in.
Right.
It spans across time.
When my dad started getting really sick with his cancer, he could still walk, but barely. And I thought to myself, wow, I should do one last project with my dad. And we decided, you know, I didn't tell him, hey, Dad, let's build one last project before you check out. I didn't say anything like that. But I said, Dad, I'd like to do, let's build another project. So he said, okay, what do you want to do? I said, I don't know. You want to build a guitar? And he says, well, that sounds like a great idea. What kind of guitar? And I said, I don't know. You want to make a replica guitar? And he said, yeah, okay. So we're poking around the internet and he says, this is called a Broadcaster. It looks kind of cool. I said, oh, that's the first Telecaster. So I said, let's make one of those. And we contacted the woodshop teacher at the high school. I don't even know if they still have the woodshop up there anymore. But we asked them, can we come up there and make a guitar? And he said, yeah, come on up. On the days when school's out. So we went up there and we built a guitar. Well, on my dad's last day, he was in his hospice bed at home. Fortunately, he was at home. And I said to him, for some reason, I knew that today was going to be his last day. He was coherent, but I don't know why I knew. And it turned out it was his last day. So I walked up to him and I held his hand and I said, hey, Dad, do you remember that guitar that we made about 6 months ago? And he said, yeah. And I said, I'm going to go get it. So I ran downstairs and I grabbed the guitar and came back upstairs. I knew if I kept talking to him, I was going to cry. So I said, let's play a song. I didn't know what song to play. I just started playing. Kind of randomly. My guitar's out of tune. But I started playing that just because I couldn't think of anything else. And he started singing it. And then I started singing it with him. My wife came in and she started singing it. My mom came in. She grabbed his other hand and was holding his hand. And about halfway through the song, he got worn out. He couldn't sing anymore, but he kept humming it. And at the end of the song, I looked down at him and one of his eyes was looking off one way and his other eye started looking the other way. And I thought, oh God, this is it. And that was it. He checked out right there. So we got to play, We got to play, we got to sing together one last time.
That's a beautiful story. Where is that Telecaster now?
I was going to bring it this morning, but I forgot. I brought a Les Paul and said, it's at home. It's just sitting on my couch.
I love the Telecaster.
Oh, do you?
Beautiful.
It's such a simple guitar. The neck bolts on and there's not much else to it.
That's what I love. I love that clean sound, the simple pickup, the humbucker, the look of it. I like, it just looks so beautiful to me. And that sounds amazing, the process of building one of those.
It was really fun to do together.
I have been talking with my guest, Gotti Hayes. This show is Human Music on Voice of Vashon, KVSH LP, your listener-supported island connection. Let's take a break for our underwriters.
Voice of Vashon thanks Windermere Real Estate for its support, making our community information programming and our emergency alert service possible. Find them on the web at WindermereVashon.com.
Support for VOB comes from Come On Barber, offering mobile appointments, pop-up barbershops, and more. Come On Barber reminds the Vashon community to stay spiffy and stay classy. Find out more at www.comeonbarber.com. That's C-M-O-N, Barber, all one word, .com.
Welcome back to Human Music. I've been speaking with my guest, Scotty Hayes, about the song Hey Jude by the Beatles. So I've asked you, Scotty, to perform a song for us live in studio. Can you tell us what you're going to perform and why?
Yeah, so you and I were speaking via text or on the phone or something like that a few days ago. And I said, well, Hey Jude is just, I guess it would just be a strumming pattern. That wouldn't be very fun to play. And I thought, well, Blackbird's kind of a cool song. And then, you know, when I was telling you that, I was thinking, I think that's finger picking. I don't know how to do that. And so I listened to the song a few times and I thought to myself, oh, I'm going to show up and I don't know how to play this song. I don't know how to finger pick. So you see the tips of my fingers right now. This morning I woke up and I thought, I don't know how to finger pick. I'm going to cover my fingertips in super glue and printer paper. And I did. That's what these things on my fingers are, so I don't bleed. And I thought, well, I better figure this song out this morning. So, but I did this on purpose. I thought it would be kind of fun to kind of go through the song and learn it a little bit and play maybe a minute of it. And we can talk about it together as we're going along. So I think we were talking earlier on about the simple patterns and major thirds and winding up the neck and coming back down again. Well, Blackbird is exactly that. It starts in G. So there's this note here and then he keeps playing this open G note here. So that's pretty simple. And he starts out playing these two strings together, I think, and then going back to this G. So that's pretty easy. And that's obviously not it. Okay, so what do? We have to go a little higher up the neck. There it is. Okay, that's just an octave higher of this. So it starts out and it goes. Oh, where does it go from there? It goes here, I think. Something like that, isn't it? And so it winds up using these major thirds and so then it overlaps here. Here's a dissonant. And then the bass note goes down here. Now there's no dissonance. It's resolved itself. Keeps coming down. Still minor thirds. Still minor thirds. Well, here's a seventh to create, I don't know, a different kind of feeling here. Now we're back to hitting those the two G's with the major third. All right, and that's Blackbird. I don't know it, but that's what it is. It's simple repeating patterns going up and down and resolving itself.
That was fantastic lesson in songwriting. So how did you learn the theory of music, or did you learn it by covering songs, or did you kind of study it on your own?
When I was seven, when my dad traded that car and swapped it for a guitar and a drum set and sent me to these places, the music teachers taught me how to read music, but not theory, which is okay. And later on in life, I got bored with reading music and I just picked up tablature, which is kind of a little bit lazier way to do things, but it worked out for me, I think. But as far as music theory, I don't know much about it at all. I hear other people talking about it and it makes sense. So I start thinking about it and, oh, I get it now. Okay, so you overlap. Yeah, some of the music theory I learned was from the Spinal Tap movie, which was just an absolute joke. They were making fun of music theory, but it makes sense.
I feel like music theory is this lifelong learning process. And I started playing as a kid classical piano music, and my teacher taught me scales, but not really, and key signatures, but not really the theory behind music. And so it wasn't until much later in my adulthood, more recently, where I'm actually thinking about how does it all work together? And it is, it's a lot of information to try to take in. Like, I always wrote songs playing some simple chords and then letting those kind of influence the direction of the song. But I was feeling kind of like you, bored, and just like, what else can I do? What else is there? Which led me down the musical theory path. But it is not easy for me. And I feel like it's just this lifelong thing that I'm going to continue trying to decipher and learn and grow.
That's great. That's fantastic. As soon as you come to the conclusion that, oh, I figured it out, I'm done, what's the point of continuing? There isn't any. You know, guys that keep learning, you see these old guitar players and their hands are just nasty and they look like they have arthritis, or piano players and their fingers are about 17 feet long and they look like they've been run over by cars, and they keep playing and they're a million years old. And they say things like, oh, today I learned this. They're still learning. It doesn't end.
That's such a great reminder, because there's that voice that sometimes comes into my head. I should be further along than I am.
Oh, that's, everybody thinks that. And that's a good thing, because that means there's something ahead instead of being stagnant.
I guess the key is to not focus on the past, what it took to get here, and the level, how fast I was or how slow I was. But you're right. It's this focus on moving forward.
Moving forward, yeah. You know, when years ago I thought, okay, so I'm starting to get into some of my guitar heroes. They're playing really fast. I heard this guy named Yngwie Malmsteen, and he played at about a billion miles an hour. And I thought, well, I need to play a billion miles an hour too. And it's hard. And you hear other guitar players in the 80s, and they were doing the same thing. They were all trying to out Eddie Van Halen each other. And I was too. You know, I wanted to, when I played with other people, you'd never say it, but I wanted to play faster than the other guy. I wanted to hit more notes per square inch, so to speak. And that became kind of my mantra. But then after a while, I thought, can I actually hum an Yngwie Malmsteen song? No. Can I hum a Beatles song? Why, yes, I can. That sticks in my head. So now, instead of playing something like that, you ask someone later on, hey, do you remember that thing that guy played on the guitar? And they're like, no, it sounded like a bunch of notes jammed in a garbage can and thrown down a hill. But when someone goes, they play something like that, and you go, oh yeah, I remember exactly what that is. That kind of reminds me of when I was in wherever and I did this thing and I had this thing to drink and eat. And I remember that. So I think a musical progression can take you wherever your headspace is. And my headspace right now is, if it sounds cool, it is cool.
I love that. I started taking bass lessons. So I play mostly guitar, and I started taking bass lessons, and my first lesson is just playing the notes, the same note on the guitar up and down the neck as slow as possible to an app that has like the drum backbeat.
Great idea,
And so I'm just playing like...
But that's the best teacher, is a metronome.
One note at a time.
Yeah, absolutely.
The same note up and down the neck.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. I mean, it's so much fun. I love this app because it kind of adds, instead of listening to a metronome, you get to listen to drums. So you feel like you're playing in a band. But it's a great reminder because it's like, it almost doesn't matter what you play as long as you're playing in time with the beat with everyone else.
That's the hardest part of being in a band is timing. When you're on your own, you can slow down and speed up and nobody cares and you don't care, but you're playing with one other person and like, ooh, we better play in sync. Not the band in sync. You better play in sync. You're playing with three people and timing is hard.
It's really hard. It's also, you know, as I'm doing this show, you know, I'm listening, I'm thinking about questions, I'm asking questions, but playing music with other people, it's quite complex as you have to play the instrument in tune, on time, and listen to what everybody else is doing at the same time. So you have to develop both skills, the listening and playing skills, and doing those both at the same time.
You got to do it all. And if you've got to be, this sounds cliche. You have to be in tune. I don't mean in tune musically. I mean in tune. You've got to know the person you're playing with. Because if one person speeds up a little bit or slows down and everyone initially thinks, oh, the other guy's speeding up or slowing down. But as many times as not, it's you, it's me who's slowing down. And you've got to know, okay, who's going to adjust? And you look at the other person and think sometimes, oh, they're going to adjust, but they don't. So you have to adjust. And sometimes that creates conflict in a band. Like, you slowed down. No, I didn't. But if you're really in tune, that's when you gel really well and you've got a good thing going then.
So funny, because I remember one show with the punk rock band I was in. The singer was upset at how the tempo of the bass intro to a song. And we got into this like knockout fight in the parking lot
about it.
Yeah, just about the tempo of the intro bass line. And it just triggered like all of this emotion and angst and don't tell me what to do. I think it should be this way. And
that's punk rock right there. Yelling about tempo in a parking lot. That's awesome.
You know, to bring it full circle. Yeah. Punk rock is about that. Beat the tempo and playing together, because you want everybody in listening to be jumping at the same time, dancing with the same beat. It is really this onslaught of sound, but it has that power because you're all in sync together.
Oh, that's a cool feeling, all being in sync together and having a bunch of noise and a bunch of distortion and a bunch of chords that may wind up and come back down. You know, it's just something simple like that. That's a Beatles song. It starts in A and winds up and comes back down.
And so what has influenced your music, do you think? Is it, what are the influence that you've had over the years in terms of developing your musical sensibility, almost like what you're drawn to and what you.
What I'm drawn to when I was younger, I was drawn to, well, I guess it's the same now. What I was drawn to is something, spectacular, this is so anti-musician, but it always drew me to bands when they were done performing, or even when they weren't done performing, when they would smash their guitar on their drum set and wreck everything and set a bomb off like the Who did, and it ruined Pete Townsend's hearing, and they kept blowing stuff up, and Keith Moon kept beating on his drums as they were falling off of the stage. Like, that's inspirational. I have no idea why, because it's so silly, but I love that stuff. Or actually people that do make music that speaks to something that I'm feeling. Or there's a guy died fairly recently, Eddie Van Halen. I always thought that was, you know, that guy is just the greatest guitar player in the universe. He plays with both hands, which you have to, but he played with both hands on the neck with all 10 fingers. And to me, it was like watching an octopus, like a freak octopus, play his guitar. And he made weird sounds that other people didn't do. I mean, everyone can make guitar sounds, but he made weird sounds. He made weird, weird sounds. And that was kind of appealing to me.
Can you talk a little bit about the performance piece of music? Like, do you feel that? I am not good at performing. I don't feel like I'm good at performing live because that performance piece is really challenging. So how do you approach the performance piece of when your band is performing? Like, what kind of mindset do you go in there with?
We played a couple of nights ago over in Seattle. And to be honest, my mindset before we started playing was, I wonder if I have time to order a fish taco.
That's awesome, Scotty. Thank you so much for being my guest today. It has been a joy.
This is fun. Thank you for the invite.
You are listening to Human Music. I'm your host, Mira Joe. I just talked to Scotty Hayes about the song Hey Jude and Blackbird. Thank you, Jim Marsh, for producing the show today. Tune in to his Whiskey Hour radio program every Friday at 9 p.m. on Voice of Vashon.